You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
A couple pieces of news. One, you have the senior VP resigns. So that's Drew Baglino. That's one part of the story. The other part of the story is that the carmaker slashing headcount by about 10%. So put those two things together, and what does that tell us about where Tesla is right now? So joining us is Steve Mann, Bloomberg Intelligence Global Autos and Industrial Research Analyst. This is a great example of why Bloomberg Intelligence Radio can bring you the best analyst from all of our guys all around the world, and Steve is definitely one of them. What has been your take over the last few hours on management shakeups as well as headcount at Tesla?
Well, it's actually worse than I thought. I thought, the first quarter sales drop was, hopefully close to the end. But, there seems to be the light at the end of the tunnel is not really here yet. And it looks like, it's running, their plants are running just pretty much well below capacity at the moment. And there's still a lot of cost headwinds facing them. They're trying to balance a lot of things in terms of deliveries, production. They're raising prices. I don't know how long that's going to last. So execution is risk. Execution is key for the company in the next 6 to 9 months.
So, Steve, where are we now, or where is the market when you talk to investors in terms of getting a sense of where EV demand is in the U.S. and then maybe globally?
Well, EV demand is waning. I think the interest rate is not helping. They're looking to, the Fed's probably not going to cut rates anytime soon in the next couple of months, next quarter or so. So that's going to continue to weigh on big purchases like automobiles. We're seeing that across the board in the U.S. as well as in China. China's a little bit worse for Tesla because there's so much new competition there. Sales is slowing for GM, sales is slowing for Ford. Ford just had to cut production of their Lightning recently announced about a couple of weeks ago. So I think this year will be tough for the industry. We probably won't see any improvement until, as far as I'm concerned, 2026.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that pushes it way out. Here was interesting headline, too, Paul, to your point, is that Reuters is reporting that BP is cutting over 100 jobs in its electric vehicle charging unit. And we all talk about how we really need chargers to deal with the range anxiety. And now you have a big player here shedding some jobs in its EV charging unit. Steve, why 2026? Why is it going to take that long?
Yeah, I think what the market, the EV market is facing today is that we had early adopters, especially on the high end. They're pretty much tapped out. They can buy only so many. The market is relatively smaller than the mass market. I'm looking at 2026 because if you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, it's bringing in onshoring a lot of the EV battery production in the U.S. Hopefully it will cut costs. And at the same time, in 2026, we're looking at more affordable EVs coming into the market. That's going to expand the addressable market for EVs. And that's why we're thinking, 2026 will probably be a better time for the EV market than it is today.
So how about profitability in that scenario, Steve? It's tough to make an argument that, these EVs can be profitably manufactured at a higher price point. how are they going to adjust their cost structure to get be profitable at maybe a lower price point? I don't know, $30,000 or something like that.
That's a good question. I think if you look at the EV startups in the U.S., the only one that's really still profitable is Tesla. You saw Fisker being delisted. There's risk of them filing bankruptcy. Both Lucid and Rivian will need billions of dollars just to get them through the next couple of years. We're not sure if they're going to get that money given the slowdown in the EV market. But on the bright side, I think Tesla is still generating cash. You know, they're making some of the cuts today, I think, really to maintain cash generation so they can continue to invest for the long term. Mm-hmm. You know, for them, I think what's really important for them is the AI, the FSD, the full self-driving system that they're trying to build out. That's going to be the future of the automotive industry. It's really those software-based subscriptions that's going to drive revenue, not so much of the automaking. So if they're trying to get there, trying to maintain cash, maintain some level of profitability to make those investments to get them there.
Interesting. I was thinking about self-driving as I was coming up the Taconic, or going down the Taconic yesterday, and I was like, would I want to be in a self-driving car right now in the Taconic? I don't know the answer to that.
You were driving?
I was driving, and I was like, I don't know, man. I think I want to trust myself behind the wheel. Anyway, before we let you go, Steve, let's go to the SVP departing. So Drew Baglino, leaving the company, as I mentioned, senior vice president. Who is he? Do we care? Like, how big a deal he was in Tesla? What did he do? Walk us through it.
Yeah, we do care. He's you know, I think he's also the face of Tesla. Looks like to be the right-hand person for Elon Musk. So it's a big loss for the company, no doubt about it. But you know, he's a powertrain engineer for the most part, energy engineer. So he's really involved in the battery. If you saw him on Battery Day, I think if you look at Tesla and what Elon Musk have been saying about Tesla's future, which is on AI, which is on full self-driving, is it a big loss? I mean, you can argue that, hey, you know, Tesla is moving on to the next phase. It's not about building the motor, it's not about building the batteries. They've gone through that process over the past 15, 18 years. You know, I think, you know, looking forward, they probably need somebody, more people around, you know, AI, you know, developing algorithms for the future of the car.
All right, Steve Mann, thanks so much for joining us. As always, Steve Mann, he covers the global auto industry for Bloomberg Intelligence based down there in Princeton, New Jersey. It's got to be tough, I think, to be like a Cathie Wood, to be so invested in this company, you know, not only financially, but kind of reputationally, and to have that, to deal with a CEO like Elon Musk is so mercurial, I guess is maybe the right term. And one of the, you know, the results of that is, you know, executive turnover, and that's got to be really challenging for investors.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting with her view is that it's so long term that I wonder if these things become just blips to her. I don't know.
Yep.
On the other side of it.
Yeah, she's very, you know, obviously had great success with this disruption kind of theory, but boy, you got to ride with Elon Musk and his foibles.
It's true. Yeah, no, that would be really hard. Would you do self-driving, by the way, in Jersey?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, okay, good.
Absolutely
so
not.
We're on the same page with that one.
Well, let Tucker drive me around. I mean, you know, I trust him.
Well, that's his second job, for sure.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's pivot to the geopolitical front, because another busy weekend in the Middle East with the Iranian attack on Israel response. Dr. Ariel Cohen joins us. He's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Dr. Cohen, thanks so much for joining us here. How would you characterize the Iranian-backed attack on Israel over the weekend? How would you characterize it?
First of all, it's an overt act of war. Israel was attacked with 300 missiles, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones. The systems worked very well, both in CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, that Israel was joined several years ago. That was the right decision to integrate Israel with its Arab neighbors. and the US, UK, France, Saudi, Jordan, and apparently UAE all participated in shooting down the Iranian missiles. But this is just a first try by the Iranians, an unsuccessful try. The largest drone and missile attack of the 21st century. Both the Americans, the Israelis, and the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese are going to learn, do lessons learned from this, and probably move to program, to plan bigger and worse strikes against each other. Mm. We saw many, many drone attacks in Ukraine. And one of the lessons learned is that massive drone attacks, the swarms of drones, as we saw, can be countered. So that's the good news. The bad news is the Iranian regime is dead set on destroying Israel. The chant every Friday in Tehran is death to America, death to Israel, and they will continue on their merry way.
So, Dr. Cohen, the question yesterday was, is this the start of a direct war between Iran and Israel and its allies, or was Iran's attack calibrated and telegraphed retaliation? It sounds like you're in the former camp of that.
The direct war of Iran against the U.S. and Israel is going on since the days of the founder of the Islamic Republic, the Ayatollah Khomeini. You remember the American CIA station chief was kidnapped and tortured and then murdered in Lebanon in 1983, Colonel Buckley. And one way or another, I was covering or studying these events now for 40 years. So it's an ongoing war, but this was an escalatory operation. And this is the Middle East. Israelis sooner or later will have to retaliate, even as President Biden is telling them to step down and take a win. When you have 300 missiles lobbed against your country, this is not going to stop there.
So, Dr. Cohen, what do you think Israel's response will be and or should be?
I think that as Israel has ongoing business in Gaza, in the northern border against Hezbollah in Lebanon, they will not be able to launch a large-scale attack against Iran. They shouldn't, not right now. But they have other tools. They have cyber. They were very successful with cyber attacks against the Iranian nuclear program. And they have other means to disrupt the Iranian military establishment and the Iranian economy.
Will this sidestep, in many ways, containment of Russia? So I follow the oil markets, and there is a narrative out there that,
right,
you know, if you wind up moving deeper into sanctioned territory or even enforcing the sanctions that are there on Iran, that opens up an avenue for Russia to sell more oil and make more money. How does the U.S. weigh these two events?
Well, let me connect this to something the Biden administration just recently did. They put a freeze on our LNG development going forward. And I think when we have malign actors like Russia, like Iran, who are oil exporters, we, the United States, Canada, and others need to produce more, not less, oil and natural gas for the market.
All right, Dr. Cohen, so I guess one of the questions here as we think about next steps is the position of Mr. Netanyahu within Israel itself. How is his grip on power? How is his ability to continue to move forward with this this conflict?
Well, I was in Israel during the attack. The morale is high, but people are sick and tired of Netanyahu. If the elections took place today, he would lose. His credibility is shot, both because of the criminal investigation that predate the Hamas attack of October 7th, and because of the huge, unprecedented failure of the Israeli intelligence and the military on Netanyahu's watch. So he may be trying to distract the attention to move on towards the Iranian confrontation I do not want to speculate, but I think sooner or later, Israel will do the right thing. There'll be a judiciary commission of inquiry like there was after the Yom Kippur War of 1973, when Israel also got a huge strategic surprise 50 years ago to the day of the attack of October 7th. And after that commission of inquiry, there will be consequences for Netanyahu, up to and including criminal proceedings. I don't want to speculate right now, but he is politically a living corpse walking.
All right, Doctor, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Dr. Ayala Cohen, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, has had extensive experience, 20 years. He served as a senior research fellow in Russia and Eurasian Studies and International Energy Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Wonderful to get his perspective. I think what's interesting, Paul, for the markets is how do you hedge the unthinkable?
Yep.
Like going into Friday, it's like, okay, you don't want to take risk into the weekend. You want to take some safety. But now, yep. How do you do that?
I know. Exactly.
Like, do you sell puts? Like, you know, I don't know.
Well, some folks are selling oil here. Brent crude down about 1.7%. Still, you know, up around $89 per barrel, but maybe a little bit of a sigh of relief a little bit there.
Oh, absolutely. And also, there's some narrative out there like, why would Iran want to hurt themselves even more on the oil right. front? Anyway, we'll discuss.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Let's get to Ben Emmons, Senior Portfolio Manager and Head of Fixed Income, New Age Wealth. He joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Ben, a million ways to go here, but let's start with some of the economic data we got today. Some retail sales came in really strong here. The consumer seems to be in pretty good shape, I guess.
It still is, Paul. I think that the employment reports are start to have an effect here, you know, because this was actually the numbers that were weak in January, February, as we talked about earlier. And if I look through these reports, and you're seeing, you know, basically items that are going to be feeding directly into GDP that were up, as well as those non-store sales. So I think what the market is doing today is to say, you know, GDP is once again accelerating. This brings us actually back to the summer of last year when we had a similar phase of having higher bond yields, started indicating that we're having a stronger economy, and this report then confirms it. So I think it's a, this just shows once again, like, we just cannot be knocked off course here no matter what gasoline prices are doing. Yeah. Gasoline sales are up too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm looking at the 10-year. I mean, rates are higher. Alex and I have been talking about this all day. Rates are up another 12 basis points on the 10-year to 4.65% here. The 2-year, we're on a 5% watch here. So the bond market's telling you, I don't know, rates are higher for longer, I guess.
Higher for longer, and if this continues, then the 10-year is going to drift towards where the Fed funds rate is, maybe not exactly, but not too far off. That would, I think, be a really interesting moment for markets, because that means that if you're getting a 10-year and a Fed funds rate about equal, should put a lot of pressure on the economy. So, but I think for now, and this is our view, that we're going to probably move into this 4.75 to 5% zone. You know, if this mm-hmm. type of data shows that GDP is going to be upgraded and the PCE is going to be mm-hmm. higher, we're going to have to expect that yields are going to be continue to reflect better growth on top of the supply that we're going to continue to have. Right? It was very substantial treasury supply.
So Ben, that definitely means like a biotech thing, because like they have the growth, they have the cash flow. They're not going to be subject to any of the refinancing, et cetera. But I'm wondering if this scenario just dents the rotation that we've seen, right? This, I'm sure, is bad for small caps. What does it do to the cyclical space?
Yeah, you could think of that, that anything interest rate sensitive, as in the small cap space, typically underperforms. We're of the view, though, that, that we think the rotation, you know, the financials energy rotation has really happened, that that's not so much derailed here. One, it shows today with Goldman Sachs, like it's just, you know, good trading environment. Mm-hmm. The energy market's obviously in play with because of the geopolitics. So I think that part of the rotation is, we think, is working. But you're right about tech, like you got to let your winners ride, as Cameron said too. Like we really have to not trade them, but basically invest in them and stay with them, because that is where it's happening in the economy. I think this is partly an impact too, once again, from all the infrastructure spending that starts to show up in the economy, making it each time stronger, right? So why we're getting so much strength with unemployment rate, unemployment, and then it feeds to spending. So I think concluding, tech remains in play here, even though the 10-year yield may go to 5%.
So, I mean, well, you're head of fixed income, so let me ask you. I can sit in a 2-year treasury at 4.95%. Should I do that, or should I go out on the credit curve a little bit and maybe look at some corporate bonds, whether it's an investment grade or high yield? How are you guys positioning?
So I put a little note out on Friday for NewEdge. I was sort of coming to the point of looking at the very short end of the yield curve, where anything that's floating rate, investment grade or treasuries, or even somewhat to extent high yield, is just performing like so incredibly stable because you're getting all this interest, right? So the spread of floating rate bonds over the treasury are anywhere between 200 to 300 basis points, depending which area you're in. That's pretty attractive. You keep collecting that interest. And if you think about what's going on with the 10-year yields, so on Friday we rally a lot on geopolitics. We come in today, we have a completely opposite picture. That's a lot of volatility. So I think from our point of view, you want to be a little bit more positioned there on the shorter end of the yield curve, because the yield curve is not going to normalize much as the Fed's on hold. You collect all that interest and give you very stable performance and sort of wait it out until we get higher yields in the long end, that at some point it's going to start slowing down the economy. We do think, though, that the buy zone for the 10-year will probably be in that 4.75-5% range. I would think that a lot of people will start looking at it and buying. We probably too.
Do you think we get to 5% on the 10-year?
I think it's fairly likely. And that's not just because of just today's number. But one thing with bonds currently is that if you look at term premiums, we call it a little like wonky term. But if you take what's expected from the Fed for the next couple of years and where inflation is, you take that out of the 10-year, there's almost no yield there. There's very little compensation. And if I then judge the way this geopolitical event is played out against an economy that doesn't get off, thrown off course, or stays above trend, the volatility of bonds, long-end bonds, will stay higher and should likely drive it a little bit up towards that 5%. Lastly, this refunding announcement that we're going to get, I believe it's on April 29th, there was something really interesting, Alex, about the TBAC, the advisory committee, that put a presentation out a few weeks ago. They actually made a forecast that T-bill supply should decline, but the long-end supply should stay the same. If the Treasury follows through on that advice, that should be refracted into the yield curve, and that isn't right now, not enough, I think, because of that low term premium. So I think for all these reasons, throwing the Fed too, that the Fed's going to, cut's going to be more and more priced out, you're going to get to 5%. You believe the technical analysis from pre-financial crisis up until now, you look at retracements, you could go even as high as 5.3, which is where the Fed funds rate is. That would be pretty extreme, I think, and it would be a real buying opportunity. We think the zone comes into 4.75, 5%.
So the Fed, what's your call for 2024? Will they cut in 2024?
So I was listening to Williams today, who had with Mike McKee, good interview. He still stays very confident that they can do it. But he's important to listen to, because he's actually the person that put out the framework on how they want to do it. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if inflation continues to get on track down to 2%, even though it's slower now, that Fed funds rate that's restrictive can be at some point cut down to take the restriction out. He thinks that they're still on course with that. I do think, though, the markets are probably more rational now about earlier this year and saying, yeah, that was not seven cuts. That's probably one to two cuts. the window is obviously narrowed a lot, right? Because as much as Powell said in the interview, I think it was also with Mike McKeown, anyone else said that the election didn't matter for them to make this rate decision. So I thought it was interesting. Probably they are going to keep that in mind, right? So the window.
I'm giving Ben a look of like.
Yeah.
All right, Ben Emmons.
Yep.
You go.
Yeah, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us, Ben Emmons, senior portfolio manager, head of fixed income at New Edge Wealth, joining us live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio. Happy Monday, happy tax day. I'm Alex Zia alongside Paul Sweeney. We are live from Interactive Broker Studio right here in Midtown Manhattan. Looking at the crude market here, you're looking at Brent down by about almost 2%. Same for WTI. So you're now at 88 for Brent, about 84 for WTI. So kind of what's next? Ellen Wald is president of Transversal Consulting, and she's a great person to talk to on the price and fundamentals, as well as the geopolitical risk. Just a handful of guys who do that really, really well. Ellen, it's great to get your perspective. I've gotten so many notes from strategists this morning on sort of what's baked in now to the oil price. What's your call? What geopolitical premium is in? How much should be in?
I think there's definitely some geopolitical premium that is baked into oil prices, but I think it's been that way for some time now. I think that because this attack happened over the weekend, the price action was really, really muted, even more than it would have been, it was otherwise, considering that there was no oil supply that was involved or threatened in any way. And so we didn't even see any, potential ups and downs or brief spikes just because there was no trading going on. I think the question really is, now that prices are kind of backing down, what's the next step? Where are things going? And if there are any indications that Israel is going to launch further attacks against Iran, or there could be more retaliatory attacks from Iran, I think that could definitely cause oil prices to go up, maybe another dollar or so. But we'd have to get some really strong indications that something incredibly major or explosive would happen in order, I think, for oil prices to really spike higher and stay higher for longer.
Ellen, talk to us about the demand side of the equation. Before October 7th, that seemed to be the driver here of global oil prices, the ups and downs of global demand. What are you seeing in terms of demand these days?
Yeah, what we're looking at is, we did see some pretty strong demand in the United States. Gasoline demand is not quite as strong this week as maybe it was in previous weeks. But when we go, looking towards the summer, I think we're expecting to see pretty strong gasoline demand over the summer in the U.S. and also what's going on with Asia, especially with China, because they're big drivers of demand as well. And I think we're seeing some reluctance in Asian buyers to buy oil or to order cargoes, more cargoes from the Middle East, because there's a concern about whether it will get there. And that's actually fueling demand for American oil, which mm-hmm. could actually either push up the price of WTI or keep it a bit more elevated as opposed to coming back down as the geopolitical premium goes down. So I think that it's kind of a complicated picture and does depend, obviously, on the economic situation globally. If we see some kind of more recession, we could see demand falter. But right now, it looks pretty strong heading into the summer.
Which brings us back to the supply picture, Ellen. So when you were talking about stronger action from Iran, the elephant in the room is closing the Strait of Hormuz, where a lot of oil passes through, and that would be a huge line in the sand for oil and would cause unbelievable spikes in the oil price. What is Iran's capacity to actually do that? Because they've gotten kind of a good gig under President Biden in terms of, their exports are up, right? Their oil exports are up. Do they really want to mess with that?
Exactly. And I think the only case in which Iran takes any kind of action to shut the Straits of Hormuz to shipping. And so remember what we're talking about is this is a small passage, and Iran could, could do this in a number of ways. It could either block it with ships, or it could fire missiles off of nearby land that could make it impossible for ships to traverse this area. But for them to really take that action means that Iran has nothing to lose. Because if Iran cuts off other ships' abilities to go through that, then you're going to see the U.S. Navy cutting off Iranian ships' ability to come through the Straits of Hormuz as well. So Iran really has to have nothing to lose. And right now, it's got a lot to lose. It's got a very thriving contraband oil industry going on. It's making a lot of money. And as oil prices go higher, even though Iran has to sell its oil at a discount, it's going to make more money. So it doesn't want to mess with that. In fact, it probably wants to sell more oil to its buyers as opposed to less. So yeah. If Biden starts to mess with that by enforcing sanctions harder, then that could kind of stir things up and make things more tense. But right now, unless Iran's oil industry is shut down, mm-hmm. if its oil industry was destroyed, then it might have the motive to do that because it's got nothing to lose.
But it's definitely not there yet. I mean, just for perspective, like in March, Iranian oil output hit a 5-year high, about 3.25 million barrels of oil a day. And the conversation we were having earlier with Dr. Ariel Cohen was, if sanctions are lined up heavier on Iran so they can't export that much, that opens the door for Russia to start selling a little bit more as well. So talk to me about how you balance, as someone in the Biden administration, how do you balance those two? How do you do that?
Well, I think the Biden administration also has to come to terms with the fact that its price cap policy on Russia is basically a failure. It's not really stopping Russia from making oil from making money on its oil industry. So yes, if Iran has less to offer, then Russia can fill in those gaps. But I think there's also the issue of Russia's participation in the OPEC Plus output cuts. And if come June, oil prices are still in the 90s, then there's going to be a lot of pressure on OPEC to raise its output. And Russia's part of that. And Russia would love to sell more oil, obviously. So this whole thing is a very complicated dance. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is going to want more oil on the market because it doesn't want high gasoline prices going into an election year. So they both want Russian oil on the market. They just don't want Russia to make a lot of money off of that oil. But it seems like they can't really have both of those things.
Well, Torsten Slok over at Apollo Management put out a chart today that for me, who's not an oil expert, was really illuminating, which is saying the U.S. is the biggest oil producer in the world with about 12.9 million barrels per day. Why don't our friends in Texas and Oklahoma just start pumping out more oil here?
Great question. And the answer is that this is not the same oil industry as it was in 2015, 2016, 2017, where it was all pump, 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 drill, 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 put out as much as you can. Don't think about what you're selling it for, the returns. It's just growth, growth, growth. That's not the oil industry now. There have been a lot of consolidations. Oil companies are running very lean games. They've really cut out a lot of fat during the pandemic. And they're at a point where they don't have to produce. They don't have to grow in order to satisfy, their shareholders. They're sitting very well. They may drill more wells, but it's become much more expensive. Inflation. We all think about oil prices causing inflation, but what we don't often think about is how inflation acts on oil production. And so everything costs more to drill now. And so they may see a benefit in not expanding drilling so much. They are increasing production by getting more out of every well, but there isn't necessarily a benefit to drill, drill, drill when they've got a good thing going right now, and it's becoming more difficult to drill more in terms of the prices, the supplies, and all of that. So and there's less incentive for them to do that at the moment.
All right, here I'm gonna go all oil nerd on you, Paul. Nice. Right? Okay, all oil nerd for you. The U.S. produces a different type of oil than the oil you're going to get in the Middle East.
Sweet crude.
Yes.
Yes.
Light sweet crude.
Light sweet.
Hey, John Tucker. We were just talking about gasoline prices.
For, yeah,
it's very sad
for you. Just real quick. Boil. B-O-I-L.
It's a great function.
all the different types of oil. It's like 60 different types of oil.
And all of them have different qualities, and you can use them to refine into different kind of products. So even if the U.S. was producing like 40 million barrels of oil a day, which obviously is like not possible, it wouldn't make up for the loss that you'd see in some of the Middle Eastern countries because they have the heavier stuff, which is really good for other products. So that is your
Thanks
Alex Lane of the morning. You are so welcome. Ellen, thank you very much. Ellen Wald, president of Transversal Consulting, joining us there. There was also an interesting article, I think it was in the Journal, that U.S. oil executives finally have a direct line to the White House, that like now their calls won't be rejected and they actually can go and talk to the Biden administration. So that was quite interesting. Oh, yeah. Like a few years ago, when a first time gasoline prices went to $5, I asked a CEO of a major oil company in the U.S., has the Biden administration called you? He's like, not even tried.
Wow.
Yeah. But now that may be changing a little bit. So there you
go. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, we need our oil and gas industry as well as we need the green stuff.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're going to get back to geopolitics front and center yet again. Aaron David Miller joins us, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joining us in Washington, D.C. via that thing called Zoom. All right, Aaron, talk to us about kind of how you view the Iranian response, the Israeli defense over the weekend here. Where do we go from here?
No, I think it's a story. Thanks for having me. Of what I would describe as the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, the good is easy. Israel's technical mastery of air defense, backstopped by the United States, its military aircraft and air defenses by the Europeans, the French and the Brits, and not surprisingly, but I think in an unprecedented fashion by key Arab states who participate in this Middle East air defense alignment of radars and intelligence, which is unprecedented. There's never been a Middle East war where at least the Israelis received that kind of support, including open support from the Jordanians, who downed a number of drones. That's the good news. The bad and potentially ugly news is, number one, in a real war, and I think the Iranians actually telegraphed this and calculated and calibrated it so that they wouldn't prompt a massive Israeli response. In a real war, the Iranians would probably launch thousands of missiles and drones. That's number one. Number two, you have new rules established now. I mean, it was 33 years, it's been 33 years since any Arab state attacked Israel directly. That was Saddam Hussein in 91, who launched 43 Scud missiles. Then Prime Minister Shamir was persuaded by the first Bush administration not to respond. But you now have new rules between Iran and Israel. Established in a rivalry that's strategic and for which there's no solution. So we're now forced to deal with the cruel realities that we're at best going to be managing this and trying to contain it. Mm-hmm. The Israelis have made it unmistakably clear, I think, that they intend to respond. The timing and the scale of that response, I think, is still very much up in the air. Maybe they'll look for a calibrated response that reinforces what has clearly been obvious, which is Israel's technical mastery and superiority over Iran. But there's no guarantee, of course, once you go up the escalatory ladder, that Iran won't respond, and then you raise the issue of Hezbollah. That's kilometers away. That's not hours away. If Hezbollah launches missiles, it's not going to take hours to get to Israel. And they got a lot of them.
Aaron, this is a pretty grim picture that you're painting at this point. What are the chances that that's how it's going to play out? Or is there a real ability for President Biden to defuse this?
You know, defusing would mean meeting Iran's and Israel's core requirements. I'm not predicting regional war, which would lead to dramatic spike in oil prices and probably plunging financial markets and a degree of instability the Middle East has never experienced before. It's a matter of managing and containing. That's the question. Because there's no solution to deal with the fact, reality, that Iran is a nuclear weapons threshold state. There's no real solution to deal with Iran's proxies. That's always been a management issue, whether the Houthis are shelling international shipping, forcing shippers to go around the Cape of Good Hope, which is additional 3,500 miles, which raises rates and interferes with the global supply chain. There are no determinative, comprehensive answers to any of this. Mm-hmm. And if we need to complicate it even more, you have an Israeli-Hamas war, although the Israelis seem to have scaled down their ground campaign in Gaza, that carries so many uncertainties, including the fate of 134 hostages, 30 of whom the Israelis believe were either killed in captivity or died on October 7th, their bodies taken to Gaza to trade for Palestinian prisoners. So, you know, I wish I could make you happy. But I'm not predicting we're going to a major regional war, but I guess my takeaway here is it's going to require a degree of restraint from Iran and Israel, and to a certain degree, some diplomacy from the Biden administration, particularly with Israelis.
Aaron, do we have any clearer picture today than we did on October 8th? What really the end goals are for Israel here? What would be a victory?
A victory, I guess, would be three things. Number one, Hamas would be, not as a political force, but as a military force, would be undermined and destroyed. So it would not be in a position to pull off another October 7th. Israel would kill the senior leadership responsible for the October 7th attacks and the redemption of the hostages. If those three things were accomplished, that would be, I think you could put that in the victory category. Although the price of victory is something that needs to be factored in into this, particularly when it involves the exponential rise of Palestinian deaths and the humanitarian catastrophic starvation. Samantha Power, the aid administrator, even used the word several days ago, famine. So I'm not sure the Israelis can accomplish those three things. Right now, 6 months into the war, there's no indication. They have not killed the senior leadership. You've got a truly tragic situation with respect to hostages, particularly the women hostages. And you have a situation where Hamas, probably out of their 30,000 fighters, have at least 10,000 fighters that remain. So I think we're talking here again about a lot of uncertainties. I just don't see a sort of determinative ending where Gaza becomes secure and stable, the Israelis and the Saudis normalize, and the Middle East remains or is converted into a happy conflict place, or everybody's getting along with one another.
All right, Aaron, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Aaron David Miller, Senior Fellow at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, is standing by. Thank you for joining us. I have to wonder then, you know, as an investor, it just means we're going to be very sensitive to any kind of headline that's going to cross, which is maybe what we're seeing in the market sort of right now. And it's going to make the overall data that we see, I wonder how much more relevant that's going to be when these headlines can be very effective.
Yeah. it seems like, you know, just to date, the market has kind of powered through all of this Middle East tension, much as it has the European geo-conflict in Ukraine. It seems to just generally bypass it and focusing on, you know, maybe a little bit more local issues, i.e. central bank policy, corporate earnings. So it may be a day-to-day basis, there might be some volatility from this. But if you look at this market really since October, which was, you know, kind of the low of this market, you know, S&P up about 25% during that time here. So despite all the geopolitical tensions around the world, much, much hotter than I think anybody would like to see, this market is moving higher.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.